shapes flit and dart in the gloom, guided by barbed whiskers twice as old as time. But look, stranger, on the floor of circumstance, where compromise scuttles crabwise, something foul is astir. Shaking its locks with a sorrowful sigh, it stands, swells and surges upwards, 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 fighting, pulsing, straining for the surface. It bursts through at last and pierces the foam, beading, bubbling, brimming to be born. It launches, streaming from the spume, muscled, boned, flanks gleaming like the future, thighs sparkling like the past, eyes flashing like the present, ball sack swinging free. It presses itself to us, hot with horned lust and rapine filth, smothering, pressing, piercing, urging into ooze and great coursing ropes of seed. The brute beast is born on the airwaves. Saturday Night Fry is alive. You are welcome, whatever your age, ethnicity, sexual preference, or chocolate-coated mid-morning confectionery biscuit snack of choice. Whether users of Penguin, Yo-Yo, Wagon Wheel, Taxi, or Club, you're all to make yourselves at home. Pull up a prejudice, pour yourself a glass of ceramide-rich, pro-vitamin, alpha-hydroxy conditioner, and be my friend. You know, friend, in the Garden of Invitation, there are many gay, gaudy displays and many ornamental fruits. Let us tuck the gathering trug under our arm and go a-picking in the guest garden. What do we see? Nodding gently in the breeze, sepals and stamina sick with pollen, I pluck the delphinium of guests. Songwriter, comic actor and sacred monster, Keith Allen. Next to fall to my secateurs, that flare of scarlet blazing amidst the white thicket of alyssum is a salvia of notorious, almost wicked beauty. It is pianist, filmmaker and dandy of the damned, Jules Holland. A fruit tree is stapled to the gable end of the guest garden, and hanging rich and full, there depends from it a Victoria plum, pulpy, firm, and weighted as a fireman's testicle. It, too, must be added to the basket, for it is pianist, composer, muser, dreamer, and thought dancer Richard Coles. At the farther end, twining about the canes like a clinging child, the sweet pea, apotheosis of the diaphane, a certain trophy for the guest drug this. Now it lies, basketed, pusely panting amongst the rest, a symbol of hurt beauty. It is writer, actor, parodist, and erotic catastrophe, John Sessions. Room for one more flower for our display. It is the wind-tossed saxifrage, English as rice pudding, strong in its frailty, beautiful as a forgotten morning, alone and frighteningly lovely. It is prince of sports writers and margrave of novelists, the divinely yielding Simon Barnes. I must now to the flower sink, where brittle green sponging and a lead crystal vase await. The arrangement of my flower guests is elegant, classical, yet refreshingly modern. It contains the breath of Britain and the colours of the world. We call it, quite simply, Saturday Night Fry. And as the sound of the mighty Wurlitzer of Bob Barrett and Roy Wooten playing Waldteufel's Skater's Waltz skims away across the ice of destiny, this is Stephen Fry throwing an arm around you, kissing your neck and making you his for the next 45. The great Vivian Stanshall wrote, "Sport, sport, masculine sport, equips a young man for society. Yes, sport turns out a jolly good sort. It's an odd boy who doesn't like sport." How odd are the boys around this table? Simon Barnes, you're a sports writer, but did you like sport at school?
Oh, no, not at all. I used to sneak out to the pub, and we used to talk about things like art and girls and that sort of stuff.
Ah, how the mighty have fallen. Jules Holland, what about you?
Not at school, no. I thought sport was for sissies, and men went to the toilets and smoked cigarettes. So that's what I did.
And now?
Now, I do take a little bit of an interest in sport. I like the idea of it. I'm still a little bit suspicious of ball games.
Yes.
But I do like to see cars going around, or dogs, or anything going around at speed.
But not cars over dogs?
No. I did think of introducing that as a sport at school. But
it used to be in the 60s, your karma ran over my dogma, I remember.
Exactly, yeah.
Richard Coles, what about you?
Sport, no. Sportsman, yes. I'm afraid it was the divine Eddie Wells, who was captain of football for Jaguars, who made a helter-skelter of my school career.
Oh, how wonderful.
You're no recovery there.
Down.
Yeah, desperately.
Keith Allen.
Yeah, I was involved in all sports at school. Loved it.
Yeah.
Which didn't mean to say I didn't smoke in the toilets or think about art and girls, but...
You had your cake and you ate it.
I tried to, yeah.
John Sessions?
I was amazed the other week when Louis de Bernier was on the show, because it was like my... He was the spitting image of Ted Sinclair, my gym teacher. A man who was rough and hard with me, but I couldn't blame him, because I was a very, very bad sportsman.
You were a girl, weren't you?
I was one of these people without the right socks, and yeah. Then there were notes, and I was one of those people, I'm afraid.
Were you the last one picked for the team? I was.
Getting on for. Another lad called Richard Dockery was always just the last man picked.
Actually, I've got a question, which you may be able to answer, Stephen, if not somebody else. When I lived with my grandmother, and she used to write notes for me quite often that would say, please excuse him from games today, because I'd sort of put it on a bit, because he's had an awful bilious attack. But I never actually knew what a bilious attack was. but I was supposed to have had them.
I think it just means sick, doesn't it? I mean, originally, I suppose it was an eruption of bile, either black or yellow, from one of your humours.
Yes. I think she should have put that instead.
That would have put everybody off, wouldn't it?
She's cupping him with leeches even now.
Well, I must confess that I was an odd boy at school. I hated sport with all the detestation that an adolescent can muster, which you will know is a lot of detestation. Had I been Stephen King's Carrie, I would have burned the pavilions, the changing rooms, the sports hall, the whole damn panoply of muddy testosterone filth. I thought that the only battle worth fighting was the battle of the aesthete against the aesthete. How does that Kipling verse go? Something about this being the man that has lost his soul, the flanneled fool at the wicket, and the muddied oaf at the goal. Fate played a cruel trick on me, however, for now I am passionately devoted to sport, so much so that an over of a test match, a frame of a snooker tournament, an end of indoor bowls, a hole of a major golf championship, a leg of darts that I miss, rankles and riles me. I suppose it's fair to say that I love games, not sport, for I must confess that athletics, cycling, show jumping and racing, are less exciting to me. I don't hate them, but the Citius Altius Fortius ethos of the Olympics lacks for me the sense of the ludic, the gamesome stories and dramas and romances that every match of football, baseball, cricket or snooker can tell. But has something gone horribly wrong with sport? More people watch it than ever. More people participate in it than ever. A quarter of all newspaper coverage. 14,000 hours a year on television. Jobs for 500,000 people in the UK and an annual £9.75 billion of turnover here. To say that sport is big business is like saying that food and clothing represent a significant sector of the retail market. Yet, drug scandals, the power of the sponsor, corporate entertaining, the corruption of bungs and match rigging, cynical fouling, artistic diving, shirt tugging, free agency, Mark McCormackism, 3D logos painted on the turf, cricketing pyjamas and white balls, Bernie Eccleston, rugby fixtures, super leagues, sports medicine and scientific training, tobacco bans, pay-per-view, overseas players, the withdrawal of the Aga Khan from British racing, one law for Schumacher, another for the rest, football club as movable franchise. For all that there is now more sport and often great sport, that moments of real theatre, gladiatorial glory, human passion, communal pride and national joy are still more available on the field of play than in the West End or in Parliament, sport is, as ever, in crisis. Amateurism and the Corinthian spirit are dead, and you can be damn certain that in 10 years' time, certain performance drugs will be accepted, video replays will overrule referees and umpires, and the superstars will be richer. There's a lot of bread in circuses. Freddie Truman, after all, was once the crude, boorish interloper and bad boy of sport. Now he is a gnarled, briar-sucking old reactionary. Ian Botham has mastered punditry, and McEnroe takes tennis stars to task as an ABC commentator. As we've found out, two of my guests, the regular and lovely Johnny Sessions, the irregular and equally lovely Jules Holland, are both not very interested in sport, so if you too, dear listener, can't abide games, then I hope you won't feel left out when I ask Simon Barnes later on, whither sport? There are questions here which are more about us than about this sporting life. But first, I turn, as is my custom, for the very lastest of last times, to our work in progress chair, which moulds this evening the maniacal form of Keith Allen. Like myself, a school expulsee and a jailbird, unlike myself, a popster, a pirate, a Fulham fan and a permanent danger dog, Keith smacks his lips with relish when the banner Bad Boy is flown over his head. The thinking man's Oliver Reed, the naughtiest man in Britain, enough spare charisma to power the national grid. These have all been said in the press about Chronechly-born father, Borstalite, Pentonvillian, Listerine bad-tooth fairy, comic stripper and chronic stripper. Keith Allen. Keith. With Vindaloo, you and Damien Hirst and Alex James of Blur outsold Three Lions and created an anthemic standard that already we hear at cricket grounds, and I dare say we will hear in netball courts and bowling greens in years to come. Are you planning to write more? A Fulham song for your new owner, Mohammed Al Fayed, for example?
Going to adapt the song, yeah. Just going to make 5,000 of them for sale at Fulham's club shop, our new club shop. And the money will go to an adventure playground that's being built in Bishop's Park.
Right, because Fulham actually has one of the nicest and most potentially beautiful grounds in London, in a way, because you've got the river.
Well, it will be. It will be probably the most beautiful ground in London, without a doubt, because I've seen the plans for the future.
Now, I have other friends who are Fulham fans, and I've tried this on them, and that is that if Mohammed Al Fayed had bought, say, Queen's Park Rangers, you would be sneering at the yuppieism, at the money, at the destruction of the good old, almost, you know, shambolic reputation, and you'd be saying, at least we haven't gone that way.
Yeah, but we don't do that at Fulham, because we know what's in store. I mean, you could pump as much money as you like, Fulham would still be kind of bad. I don't think that we've got Premiership stamped on us. I don't think we're destined to stay. I mean, Fulham are always a very, very good old second division club. That's what they traditionally have been.
And you've been since a small boy.
34 years, I've been playing, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're in danger.
And the fact that you're famous now, does that worry? I mean, do you stand in the terraces or do you stand at smoking mannequins with the sheepskin car coats in the director's box? No.
Sit in the terraces. Yeah.
Sit in
the terraces. Yeah.
Most of your fame, I suppose, tends to spring from playing villains. Right the way back, I can remember, aside from the comic strip days, things like Very British Coup and obviously Martin Chuzzlewit and so on. Mm. Do you yearn to play a nice, sensitive soul? Or do you actually enjoy playing?
I think I did, in Born to Run. I mean, that character that I played there, Byron Flitch, he didn't have a kind of jot of nastiness about him whatsoever. I thought he was a fairly rounded, reasonable, warmish human being. So I've done it, I can do it.
And do you worry, I mean, I sometimes worry that if I do too many check-shows and things like that, that I won't get cast in nice parts because you suddenly become a person rather than an actor. Do you worry that your reputation, there have been a few occasions where you've broken up live late-night check-shows and so on and been a bad boy, that might not stop you because people don't want to work with you, but might stop you from playing something utterly different?
It happens.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it, no. I mean, I'm lucky. I happen to believe that if you're a performer, which I am, you can go and perform in any area, which I've done. I mean, I've presented chat shows, I've presented youth TV shows, I've made records, I used to be a stand-up comedian. I mean, there's all sorts of things I can do.
And you don't see a distinction. You see them all as a part of performing. Even we were in the National Theatre, I remember seeing in Pinto, for example.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of rankles with me that you do get pigeonholed, people tend to ghettoise what you are and they like it that way because it makes their life easier. But I think that you should be allowed to do whatever you like, really.
Yeah. But now, when I say the words stand-up diamond geezer, I can only be referring to Jules Holland, who Pache Nick Lowe must stand as the real Jesus of cool. B.B. King, the legendary blues guitarist, said, "Jules is a real nice person. He had never known he was so great until he plays." We're about to hear how great he is as his fingers wander far from idly over the noisy keys, giving us Fingers and Thumbs.
Just drifting around from got the new taste of a decent hot stew. Oh, fingers and thumbs, their luck is their life. Just drifting around from day until night. Just drifting around from day until night.
Oh, Jules, thank you so much.
You forget how brilliant he is.
I know. Jules, someone said of you in the papers recently that your career seems to have been shaped like one long fantasy. You play with your musical heroes, you live in a stunning Greenwich house with a stunning partner and stunning children, and have the run of a real-life railway station, Helicon Mountain, as I think you call it. Everyone adores you, you dress well, you move between Tuscan aristos and Brick Lane mashers with soigné ease, you make programs on your enthusiasms from jazz to architecture, the world is at your feet and it tickles them. Obvious question. Regrets?
This show. No, I think, I like being me. I think that's good. And I like having a nice time. And really, what I'm trying to do is to live and set an example. If I have a nice time, then perhaps everybody can have a nice time. Yeah. And then it'll sort of spread more and more. But, yeah, I can't think. No regrets spring to mind. No. I think you will make the odd mistake here and there. But there's not much point in worrying about it too much. No. You just have to move ahead.
You never had, famously, a music lesson in your life, as it were, except the music lessons of listening to lots of music and loving it. And I think you once said that people who don't know anything about the history of the music they play are unlikely to play it well. Is that something you believe in?
Well, I think that's true to a certain extent, because I've found that all the people that I like and admire, and in fact I met a concert pianist in Hungary the other day, and he had exactly the same view, and he was a great natural musician and also very clever at reading music, so you had the two things, but you have to be aware of all the things that have been before. And even if you talk to, say, a Beatle, or if you talk to any musicians that are successful, they normally have a huge knowledge of music, not just the sort of music they're involved in, but just music generally.
Yes,
they have
Elton John's record collection, for example.
Elton knows an enormous amount about everything musically, because he has to, because they have to take it in. You can't sort of, it can't come out unless you've taken a lot in, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the other reason people enjoy playing music is because you grow all the time. There's always something new to learn. Or something fresh that you can get you going. And it is like a fix. I think one of my gurus musically would be Keith Richards, who is, because he's listening to music all the time, constantly listening, and sometimes he's listening and he's doing what I'd say is trawling, song mining, if you like, looking through the scene, trying to find something that will get his attention. And other times, when he's trawling, he might be going through records that were made a minute ago, or 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it doesn't matter. But all the time trawling, looking for that thing that's going to give you that lift. And then the rest of the time, he'll play things he knows will give him that lift and that excitement.
Rather like Glenn Miller in the Glenn Miller story, where he's James Stewart talking, I'm looking for that sound.
Yeah.
Of course, Keith will never go out with that supermodel, because, as we know, a Rolling Stone gathers in
every
morning. Anyway, sorry, I'm so sorry. But anyway, from a stand-up diamond geezer to a sit-down amethyst honeybun, John Sessions, the best and wisest friend that Saturday Night Fry has ever known, he gives now a last blast on his golden idea trumpet. Corporate entertaining and the horrors of sport have swallowed up the great events of the season: Henley, Ascot, Cowes Week, drag racing at Santa Pod, and, of course, Wimbledon. Sessions dives deep for us into this ghastly world.
Now, Zoran, you watch Richard as he prepares to receive. You're looking at his feet, yes?
Yes, Uncle Dimitri.
And at Goran's grip as he is about to serve.
Yes, Uncle Dimitri.
Oh, this is good. It's a good point. This is a better lesson than I could ever give you.
It's just in here, Mr. Walmsley-Macott.
Look, I know it's just in here. This is my fourth Wimbledon, isn't it? Hang on. This is a cupboard.
I was pointing at this door, sir.
Look, we'll just drop what passes for you as a joke, shall we? What we won't drop, though, is the parking issue.
Mr. Walmsley-Macott, you were over an hour late, sir. We had to give your parking place to another guest.
Had to give it to Mike Hopley Nelligan from Unibiscuit? Don't think you had to give it to the man who laboured round the clock to secure my dismissal from Seagram's. but I want to leave this because I shall be taking that up with his MD tomorrow. What concerns me at this actual point in time is that my driver is going to have to spend the whole afternoon eroding my petrol allowance as he swans around Wimbledon.
Look, I really have got to go now, sir. I think you should settle down or you may distract the players. I suggest you take this up with Mr. McCormack tomorrow. Do enjoy the game.
Oh, I will. Self-important bastard. You know, you give an Englishman a blazer and you give him a license to run a concentration camp. Yeah! Oh, God! Oh, Sherry.
Uncle Dimitri, what is this man saying about the concentration camp? Who is he?
I told you about them earlier, Zoran. They're businessmen. You just watch the game, like I tell you.
What are these foreigners doing in our box, Gary?
I told you, Brian. In fact, we should talk to them in a minute. Introduce ourselves.
Can't really remember the time when I had to talk to anyone, Gary.
Brian, please. You keep your voice down. People are looking.
Gary, what you see about you aren't people. They are plebs. Plebs! And they are looking. Yeah, look, he's looking now. Because they are jealous. And this is a sensational box. Krychek there, Goran there. Oh, I love tennis. Oh, let me just finish that story.
Please, be quiet. We try to watch game.
Not as hard as you try to speak the English and failing big time, my friend. Oh, do you know where the fridge is?
No, I do not know where the fridge is.
Oh, come on, the fridge. You know, a big white cold thing with booze in it. Oh, I assume they're ex-Eastern Bloc. Got those sort of haircuts. Oh, there it is. Oh, I don't believe it. It's a poo-less sodding fridge.
But this isn't our box, Brian.
It is today, Gareth.
Okay.
Hi, boys. Me am Brian Walmsmacott, Finance Director, Biscuits UK, Stocious as Farsky. But I'm just promoted and doing very well, thank you, please. So, bit of respect. All this, my sponsorship.
We wish you please would sit down.
Will do, my friend. But wouldn't just mind a drop of civility out of your samovar first.
Uncle, please. This man, he drives me crazy. We call an official, yes?
Oh! The little comrades answer to everything. Call an official. Send them to the salt mines. Do I detect a little teenage petulance? Nothing new for me, son. I got me own sprogs. Peter and Samantha. Terrific kids. Love them to death. Drive me crazy, of course, but I only have to see them every other weekend. Still, there are times when...
I'm glad I never have to see you at any weekend. You not hear the shushing?
Look, I'm absorbed in a conversation, Mr. Ivanisovich. Not everyone wants to watch your each and every move.
No. So most people here just come to talk any bloody thing that come out of their fat mouth. Oh, well, now I know. Thank you for putting me in the picture. Thank you.
I would just remind you, Goran, to look at your shirt. That's right. Examine that logo. Biscuits UK. We put you where you are. And where, may I ask, is Mr. Krychek? Gone off on a little tent by any chance?
Oh, glad you remind me. You think I am fed up? Well, you wait till you see him. Should be any second now, fat blubbermouth.
Where is this guy? Ah, why you come to tennis? You stop the bloody game with your fat talk. What are you doing in the box with my uncle and little cousin? I get this box for them. I'm so sorry, Mr. Krychek. Must be a mistake. We'll just go. Yes, Brian? Look, I'll just go and get the bloke from McCormack's.
Yeah, you do that, Gary. This should be very interesting. Mr. Krychek, my program tells me you are a Czech. Now, you and that other loping oaf cannot begin to conceive how much a box like this would cost. A million trabants and the entire inner metropolitan area of Prague could not pay for this box.
I have paid for it, fat man. You spoil my game with Goran. You spoil the afternoon for my uncle and my brilliant little cousin Zoran. You deserve to be fed used tennis balls until you die.
Well, I can't believe I'm hearing this. Some kind of Slavic curse. Oh, Gary, the very man. Do tell me what Mr. McCormack would like to do about this pathetic display of petulant sportsmanship.
He wants us to leave, Brian.
Leave?
Yes, there was no box for us. He asked Mr. Krychek's family if they would mind two businessmen sitting in the box. They didn't mind until we arrived. And then, of course, they did. And, indeed, everyone in Centre Court minds. Mark McCormack minds and is planning to sue you. And a man over there is asking the umpire if he could get a rope from the boot of his car and hang us both from the stand. That man is our managing director. So I would assume that our company car has gone, along with our careers. I think I'll just go along and get hanged first. It'll be less embarrassing than having to wait for you. Bye, Brian. I'll try to remember the good times.
Right. Well, I'll be off then. You commies, you don't change your spots, do you? That bony, sullen child there would be up a chimney in a salt mine today were it not for sponsorship from people like me. No, shut up! Shut up! I don't need to be here! I don't need to be here with any of you! I am going where I am wanted! And where might that be, Mr. Out of a Job? There is a powerboat convention in the Solent, Goran. And that, my friend, is where I should have been all along. I don't need you. Any of you! I've got a tie signed by Jeremy Clarkson. Think about that when I'm gone, will you?
Oh, John, John, John. If thanks were glasses of wine, I would say such things as would make you inebriated beyond the reach of medicine. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we may not do much sportingly in Britain, but we do produce some great sports writers. The best manage to write wittily, passionately, knowledgeably, and honestly, without falling between the dreary Scylla of humorless Papa Hemingway machismo or the ghastly Charybdis of cheery Fiddistonism. Simon Barnes is the best of the best. He wrote lately, for example, of the Tour de France fiasco. For many, the fact of the matter is that you do not need drugs to win. You need drugs simply to take part. He wrote of Michael Atherton not walking when clearly hit on the glove at a recent test match. In test cricket, no one walks. No one gives himself out. It matters too much to the individual, to the team. Every fielder appeals at anything and at every opportunity screams like a nun finding a naked man in the convent. But, Simon Barnes, W.G. Grace, was famous for refusing to walk even when given out. Atherton, the ball tampering incident long forgotten, was named Man of the Series for England this year. He is our dogged hero. We actors are notorious for moaning at critics, but never, ever do we have write-ups like England's shame or national disgrace. You journalists surely contribute as much as anyone to the high cost of losing and therefore the willingness of sportsmen to do anything to win. It's not just money, it's the searchlight you put them under, isn't it?
Absolutely right. I mean, that is exactly what sport is about. An elite sport is about very, very high stakes. You're putting not just a couple of quid on the line, you're putting your entire personality on the line, and it's a very dangerous game, and a lot of people don't survive. A lot of children come into the game and fail to make it in a kind of turtles in the sea situation, and those that do make it often fall off. It's the theatre of cruelty, sport is. That's why we like it.
There's a kind of great deal of inconsistency, not just from journalists, but I suppose from all sports fans, that on the one hand, of course, we want our heroes to win. On the other hand, some people can say mad things like, you know, Paul Gascoigne is an ambassador. Well, we give people automatic knighthoods, a whole load of old Etonians who are actually ambassadors, and they get paid a decent wage and live in lovely houses. Why Paul Gascoigne should be considered an ambassador strikes me as being absurd, don't you agree?
Well, the whole role model thing is a very baffling one to me. It's, I mean, when I hear the words role model, I reach for my revolver. The Sir Charles Barkley, the American basketball player, said, I'm not a role model. Parents are role models. I can slam dunk basketballs. I've known dope dealers who can slam dunk basketballs. I'm not a role model. My job is to wreak havoc on a basketball court. And that's what Paul, what Gascoigne's job is to do. He wreaks havoc on football fields among various other places, and he's not there to be admired save as a footballer.
No, but when he gets drunk on a plane, all the bourgeois tabloids maunder on about what a disgrace and letdown he is, which is...
Absolutely, I think that he's letting anybody down terribly much. What he does is play football, and that's a good bit about him.
Yeah. On the other hand, of course, the moment they do well in sport, we tend to regard them as somehow having achieved something that stands for the nation beyond the game itself.
which, of course, is playing that game the other way around. We credit them with a kind of ambassadorial role when it's good, even if we don't agree with the idea of role models.
It's because winning is so wonderful, isn't it? That's the whole thing about sport, is the emotional excitement of it. It was an American gambler who said the most exciting thing in life is winning, and the second most exciting thing in life is losing. No, as a Fulham fan, I can see you empathising with that.
I remember as a child being at a lunch during, I think it was the 77 Australian tour of England with Ashley Mallett and Ross Edwards, two not particularly well-known Australian test cricketers, and they both represented absolutely opposite points of view. Ashley Mallett said he was leaving international cricket because the pain of losing was more intense than the pleasure of winning. Ross Edwards said not. I think now everyone's gone his way, that people go out of their way to avoid losing because that's worse than winning is good, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. It is a frightening business. I mean, people think that it's an enviable job being a professional athlete. It's not. You live with fear. Fear is... I mean, they all tell you that you interview them. They say things like, you know, never have a negative thought. If you don't think you can win it, you shouldn't be out on the pitch and all that kind of stuff. And it's total lies. They've all known a bit of sports psychology and they know you have to kind of work on this.
Yes.
But what happens is it's all about raw fear and fear of losing. They all live with it. And the great ones can work this sort of process of alchemy.
Yeah.
From the base metal of fear into the golden victory.
The trouble is, of course, everyone has a different idea about what is wrong with sport. Some people think what's wrong with sport is that Colin Montgomery occasionally looks extremely hacked off and petulant. And yet others think what's wrong with sport is that people like Nick Faldo are mechanical. I mean, most sports lovers think you can have a Jimmy White or a Ronnie Sullivan as well as a Steve Davis. We don't want just automata. On the other hand, the idea of moving out the petulant, explosive people would be a disaster too.
Oh, of course it would. It's, I mean, sport is a pursuit for all sorts and conditions of men. And I've got a great enthusiasm for the boring and the attritional. I mean, otherwise, how else would you set your diamonds, your explosive characters? And if it wasn't for the wonderful explosive characters, how else would we empathise with them that the pain of their losing as Jimmy White goes down for the 19th time in the final?
Yeah. Of course, the commercialisation of sport ramifies in more ways than the obvious. Perhaps the interstices between sport and art have blurred to the point of indistinction. Are they two discrete cultures, or does that way madness lie? Only Richard Coles and his 88 black and white chums, the Piano Keys, can make sense of it all. Richard.
Well, are sport and art really two discrete cultures? Aren't they, in reality, overlapping egregiously? For example, Arsenal captain Tony Adams, when he's not writing symbolist verse, can be seen at Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh at the Almeida Theatre in fashionable Islington. But that's not so surprising. For an Arsenal player, the Gunners being, for many years, the favourite club of the footy-loving East Seat. Nick Hornby, Lord Bragg, Pierre Boulez and Rilke were all season ticket holders. But it goes back even further than that, to the middle years of the 19th century, and not to North London, but to a bougainvillea-clad monastery in northern Mallorca, where Frédéric François Chopin composed this little-known, but strangely familiar, F major nocturne. Off there. And Chopin's interest in the beautiful game didn't stop at Highbury. A close examination of a little-known C minor mazurka suggests that his love of football was all-embracing. ¶¶ last, a link is established between a grinning Michael Owen, Dion Dublin, Sasa Illich, Paolo Onechop, and 19th century romantic nationalism. Stephen, only connect.
Thank you very much, as always. Making sense of the senses. I have a question for you, Simon Barnes, which I'll open out, as it were, particularly perhaps to Keith. And that is the explosion, particularly in soccer, of the last few years, has seems to have created a bit of a gulf that may be meaningless in other countries, but seems to speak to the heart of our class consciousness. And that is that the yuppie incomers, as it were, into soccer, all the girls and rich boys and the people who can afford a Chelsea season ticket now, are often resented for their love of football. In fact, you hear occasionally Tony Banks or others saying it's a working class game and it's not the business of anyone else to get interested. They're not real soccer fans. Is that reducing the game, in fact? Is that a sort of crystallising it or popping it into a cage?
Yeah, it's a vexatious one, that. I mean, you can't actually call it exploitative, can you? Because you have got a choice of whether you go to watch Chelsea or not.
No. But what about you, Keith? Do you feel, as a die-hard Fulham fan, been going for 30-odd years, do you sometimes see people there in pinstripe suits and mobile phones and you think you're not the real thing, or do you welcome anybody?
It's never been a problem at Fulham, you know, because we don't have kind of 35,000 people, 20 of whom aren't there anymore, who've been replaced by those mobile phone-wielding buffoons. You know, we've never had that problem down there. But I see your point, but in the end... In the end, there's another way of watching football now, you know, which is to go to a boozer and watch it on Sky Television. And it's kind of another experience of watching football that wasn't available to you 10 or 15 years ago. You know, things mutate, things change.
Can I put in a plea for Johnny-come-lately mobile phone-wielding football fan, which is me? I mean, I didn't get into football until 1990, and it was actually the glistening hands of Gary Lineker that first attracted me to the sport.
Kevin's tight.
Exactly.
But
it was that that got me in. But now I'm a loyal and devoted fan of Russian and Diamonds, which is a Vauxhall Conference side. Fourth last season, thank you, and about to go up for the next season. The home of gallantry in the heart of the East Midlands. And
he's played for them once.
Indeed. And it just sort of bothers me slightly that somehow, that because of my background or my credentials, that somehow I'm not as entitled to take up my place in the territory as anyone else. I agree.
Now, the Tour de France business, I mean, it was just, I use the word fiasco, and that's putting it lightly, isn't it?
It was the most extraordinary thing. And one of the most extraordinary things was the way the French people did not turn away from the Tour. They didn't say, well, I no longer like cycling, I no longer like cyclists, they're no longer heroes. Because they take drugs, they have become considered as heroic victims.
They cheered the field into Paris.
Exactly.
Didn't they?
They are victims. They are victims of the money culture, of the sponsors culture, of the need to take drugs. It's simply in order to take part. It's not the winning; it's the taking part that counts when it comes to getting to the old pharmaceuticals.
Well, some people have suggested that because it now becomes a question of my pharmaceutical is better than yours, that actually there will be two classes of event, rather like altitude or indoor and outdoor races. You will have pure and open. You will have open races, which are open to people who have taken performance drugs, and winners will win, and you'll have pure ones where everyone will be guaranteed not to, who'll have slower times. Yes, is that really feasible?
I don't think that one is feasible, Juan Antonio Samaranch, the president of the International Olympic Committee and probably the most powerful man in sport, has floated the idea that only drugs that are known to be harmful to the health will now be banned. It's a suggestion floated.
That means it's a short way from ones that aren't being accepted.
Well, precisely. And the thing is, it shows a total failure to understand the way an athlete's mind works. You give an athlete a pill and say, it won't do you any harm if you have one a day, and you'll go a lot faster.
And of course,
what it would be if I took 28? Just think how quick I'd be then.
And people make their own drugs.
Nobody else is going to have the bottle to take 28, so I will have the edge.
And I think people will want to see Ben Thompson, not Roger Bannister. You know, people will want to see the person who runs quickest.
Still, there's still the record that's never been broken.
And it happened
7-9.
With the altitude training, which is a question of the body making its own drugs, as it were. When the Finns suddenly wiped everyone else off the field, that was regarded as a kind of drug taking.
Yes, absolutely.
How is alcohol thought of?
But that's the question. Isn't it? Alcohol is a question of how you respond to it. Certain people can play having had a big night out on whatever it is on vodka, and other people can't.
Yeah, it's like cigarettes, push gas. You smoke 30 a day. One of the greatest footballers that God ever saw, but certain players couldn't smoke 30 in
Birmingham.
Well, of course, it would be a madness of the worst and most worrying sort to have a Jules Holland in the studio, and use him only once. This self-taught master of stride, boogie-woogie, jazz and blues is seated once more before the open, smiling teeth of the studio Steinway and will give us a small piece.
Here's a small piece, and I'd just like to explain, as we are talking about sport and achievement, I wasn't sure what to do, but it's come to me now. Most people would play, if they were going to play a boogie-woogie piece, one that had 12 bars. I intend, and you can count them if you wish, to use 13. Thank you.
Deck of cards divided into suits of 13. The native wood notes wild of Julian Miles Holland yield to the dictates of that foul strumpet, time, reminding us as tears flow unprompted and unchecked that these are the final moments of the final show. What can I say of Richard Coles, who four times has answered my call and found splendor, and John Sessions, the Muller fruit corner of reason, the pepperami of principle, the magnet and southern sliding patio door of wit and integrity. His kindness, brilliance and insight have spoken for themselves. But I metaphorically nonetheless snuggle into his armpit and whisper words of thanks and indebtitude. This week's guests, Jules Holland, Keith Allen and Simon Barnes, have been monumental. I thank them and their predecessors, each and every one. You won't know them, but Paul Wones at the mixing desk, Jackie Klein, our work experience pixie, under the guidance of Kathy Marnie and Chris Wilson, have made this octet of evenings a deep pleasure for me. We owe, of course, a debt that words can never pay to Bob Barrett and Roy Wooten, whose mighty Wurlitzer for the last time bids us drink that cup of kindness yet. Mostly of all, however, there has been this silly old microphone that has been the conduit between myself and you, the listener, the reason for it all. Whatever you've thought of these programs, think this. Spoken word wireless is a glory that must not depart, even as we now do depart with a dying fall. I blow love-laden kisses into the sweet conches of your ears. There, let them grow. The April is in my eyes. It is love's spring. I can no more. Here ends Saturday Night Fry.